you got
problems that you ought to be concerned with.
Moolah!
You don't know how you're supposed to earn it, or what to do with it, or how to keep it. You're a freak with a dark, shameful secret.
But you're not the only one. Hit your hidden financial fears with a blast of sun. Now your healing has begun. It's Bad with Money with Gabby Dunn.
Hello, I'm Gabby Dunn, and this is Bad with Money. We really can't talk about money anymore without factoring in racism in all facets of our economy, in all facets of wealth, in all facets of the distribution of wealth. And we've been talking to a lot of incredible Black luminaries and activists and journalists on the show, so go check out those previous episodes. But today we are going to cover COVID-19's economic devastation on tribal lands. This was an idea that was brought to me by our producer, Tamika. And, you know, this is our second to last episode of season six. And season six has been a whirlwind in terms of everything going on while we were making the show. And I don't think that there has been enough said about the ways in which the pandemic is basically devastating the businesses of these tribes. So, I mean, I wanted to get into it and I wanted to find out what's going on with these tribes who basically had to shut everything down to protect their citizens who run these businesses that not just people that are in the tribes, but people that live in the areas work at. You know, they work at the casinos, they work at the hospitality businesses that the Native Americans run. And so what have they been doing to protect their own nations during this time? So basically, there's so much that I think I did not even know about the ways that Native economies work. So luckily on this episode, we have Karen Diver, who was an appointee of President Obama as the special assistant to the president for Native American affairs and a former tribal chairwoman. I wanted to talk to her about the Native Americans' incredibly different way of looking at the pandemic, the ways in which they've been hit the hardest, and the ways in which our government is failing them. So let's get into it. For my listeners, can you tell them who you are and what you do?
Sure. I'm currently the Director for Business Development for Native American Initiatives at the University of Arizona, specifically the Native Nations Institute. I was formerly the chairwoman of the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, which is an elected position, and I was the special assistant to the president for Native American affairs in the Obama White House.
That's awesome. What did you do in your capacity at the Obama White House?
I was in the Domestic Policy Council. So all of the policy initiatives that came out of 27 different federal agencies. So I worked with those agencies to make sure that we were all kind of had the same plan and were advancing the initiatives that were a priority for tribes and the president.
And what do you do at your job now?
So we are developing a School of Indigenous Governance and Development at the University of Arizona. We were pretty close to announcing it, got a little sidelined by COVID, but we continue to offer through the Native Nations Institute, both direct services to tribes, as well as academic and professional development training for tribal leaders and executives.
Starting with a blank slate, like, let's assume that people listening don't know anything about how Indigenous people live today. Can you describe the economies of some of the tribes, at least how they were pre-pandemic?
So there is no easy one answer to that. There are 574 tribes. A little less than half of them are in Alaska. So the rest are in the lower 48. There is some perception that there is unlimited gaming wealth from casinos, which would not be the case. Only a little over 40% of tribes, 245, have some type of gaming or hospitality enterprises. Of those, many of them are rural, very rural, and operate kind of like jobs programs. But for the medium and larger tribes, They would operate very much like a tribal treasury. It's an alternative tax base, since tribes don't have any other way to get revenue other than from the federal government, smaller amounts, much smaller from any state or philanthropy. Anything they're going to do for their own citizens, they have to figure out a way to earn it above and beyond any of that grant making. So a little over 5 million Native Americans in the United States, and they stretch from coast to coast all the way to Alaska. And then we also include Native Hawaiians as well in that number.
And so a lot of the each reservation and tribe kind of runs on its own government, yes?
Very much so. Tribes are independent political entities. So people often confuse tribal citizens, their political status versus their racial status. And the relationship we have with the U.S. government is based on our political status. That's how we were able to do treaty making with the United States back in the day, was based on a government-to-government relationship.
That's so interesting to have. I don't know how many people who are not indigenous understand that there's a governments inside of our government or our country that interact with the federal government in their own individual ways.
So they're considered domestic dependent nations. So like Guam, for example. So that, Guam, Puerto Rico, they have their own governance, right? But they're not independent sovereigns either. So domestic dependent nations is generally the term that is used. And the dependence part of it actually comes from a wide body of, over 250 years of federal Indian law that defined the relationship between the U.S. government and tribal governments based on the treaties and what was promised in them.
So I was doing a bunch of reading about how COVID affected Indigenous peoples, but can you talk about how did the pandemic affect Indigenous peoples differently?
So I started out by talking about these 574 tribes. So there is a wide variety of ways that it is impacted, but probably the most egregious we saw with the Navajo Nation and now expanding to the other tribes around Navajo with the Pueblos and the Utes, where there's just been really explosive growth in COVID. Navajo Nation is operates on a fairly large homelands, very, very large, larger than most East Coast states. But there's very rural communities, there's food deserts. Some of the communities on Navajo lack access to regular running water and or electricity, multi-generational households. So there was one large spreader event that happened in the beginning, and it was actually a church service. And then when people went back to their home communities, it kind of turned into a super spreader situation just because of those multi-generational households and the isolated communities and just the vast expanse of trying to get a handle on how do we close borders when the only food would be in a border town. So they had to stand up a whole lot of infrastructure in order to meet those needs with, volunteers coming in, doing home-delivered food to assure food security. And then the federal government hasn't really dealt well with them. They sent them faulty PPE in the beginning, and then the CARES Act money, which was federal resources that were supposed to come to tribes, was delayed because of some dispute with the federal government on including Alaska Native corporations in the funding formula.
Why?
Because they're not tribes. They're corporations. And there are Alaskan villages that have representative governments, and tribes operate on behalf of shareholders, not necessarily citizens. But it ends up being complicated because many of those corporations also do some level of service delivery just because they're regional and have more capacity. So there was some dispute, and it ended up in court on whether or not that they were eligible. And so rather than just distribute what wasn't being disputed, the federal government chose not to distribute any of it until that was resolved. So you also have some hard-hit tribes, Oneida tribe in Wisconsin. There was some in the Northwest that got hit hard. Many tribes just shut down. They just shut down all of their enterprises, all of their government services. There was a few that instituted border checkpoints just to make sure that nobody was coming into the community to spread it. We just have high rates of our elderly are often very much prized in our community and regarded as knowledge keepers, language keepers, culture keepers. And so a large part of our cultural traditions was driving our public health response in terms of wanting to protect our elder population. So, you know, it was a little different of a dynamic than you saw, you know, in America otherwise, where it was kind of people were looking at individual liberties. We were looking at community care principles and caring for one another, especially the most vulnerable. So tribes shut down from coast to coast. They shut down to protect their citizens.
Yeah, I was reading like in South. This is from an article. In South Dakota, tribes set up roadblocks to protect their citizens. This is from The Guardian. After the pro-Trump governor refused to issue a stay-at-home order in Washington, the Lummi Nation created the country's first field hospital. And then, you know, the Navajo Nation has been really doing a lot of testing and has, even though like they have a infection rate that I guess is five times that of the U.S. as a whole, they've like basically done a better job of shutting down than anywhere else. And I wonder, like, why do you think that is? Like, they just took it way more seriously?
Yeah, you know, as I was speaking, that community care principle and that sense of connectedness to one another, and the special regard we have for our elders, which, you know, that was the first information coming out about COVID, was that it was going to have a disproportionate death rate on elder populations. And those are universally amongst all the tribes. You know, our elders are just so highly regarded, and it's precious time. There was a time when the average age of death in the 70s for an American Indian was 56 years old. So now to be able to have our elders, our parents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents into their 70s, 80s, 90s or older is a precious gift. It's a precious gift of knowledge. And those relations are precious. So even a young person who maybe, you know, along with their peers might feel a little bit more insulated from the effects of COVID, understands the responsibility of being a carrier and takes greatly the responsibility of protecting the older people and their family. So it was an easy decision for tribes to shut down because the alternative is about money. And we've been poor before and survived. But the preciousness of that elder population is much more of a priority. The rest is inconvenient, but the other parts of it are life-changing when we lose our elders.
What do you mean it's about money, like shutting down the native economy or the casinos?
Right, right, right. Shutting hospitality enterprises, golf courses, you know, the casinos or whatever they may have, you know, tribes lost their treasury, their ability to fund, you know, government services and had to really kind of prioritize, you know, service delivery and then forego some of the other government services in response to losing that ability to self-fund.
What other services?
Transit facilities, you know, they lost, some places closed down their gas and grocery stores if for a while until they could figure out how to open them back up safely with restrictions, trying to figure out how to get food to kids when the schools were closed early, knowing that that could create food insecurity, how to maintain elder nutrition services. They had to keep their police departments running, you know, but on the other hand, maybe a public works department was closed and projects put on hold. Maybe some of the routine maintenance that might be done on public housing stock might be deferred because you don't want people going into homes and being a carrier or catching something and bringing it to their own family. So, you know, tribes were clinical services, you know, many tribes operate health facilities, dental facilities. You know, how do you do that and maintain a handle on chronic conditions, but look at, you know, ambulatory care very much differently, and doing telehealth, trying to figure out how to do telehealth and having public health nurses call families to get symptoms and prioritize health needs. So, you know, it was a lot for tribes to be able to handle, and they were adapting on the ground. And I think that most tribes have some experience with emergency planning, but I think even the most experienced emergency planners were, it was hard to foresee something like this, I think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Let's pause here and take a quick break. We'll be right back. And we're back. So can we talk about, because COVID, you know, the whole thing was like wash your hands and use hand sanitizer and all that kind of stuff. And can we talk about the sort of indoor plumbing aspect of it? Because I think... it's like race is a big predictor of access to indoor plumbing. And you mentioned that a little bit briefly. But what is the situation or what is the disparity there?
So I would say that disparity around access to indoor plumbing is most affected in Navajo just because of its size and how remote some of the communities are. Other communities more deal with access to quality water, you know, potability, where at Navajo, you know, it's actually the issue of it being plumbed into the home and things like, and then electricity. So Navajo, I think, was most impacted by all of that. You will also see some of those issues in some of the remote Alaskan villages.
And what do you mean by potable? Like, why don't they have access to potable water?
Well, for Navajo, for example, you know, some of their water has been contaminated by previous uranium mining and other mining activities. You know, one of their aquifers was drained by with coal mining prior to it shutting down. You know, so sometimes it's external factors around the quality of water, and then some of it is the very rural nature of most tribal communities and reservation homelands.
Yeah, because we hear about that, about, you know, digging and all these things that where it's like people don't seem to care at all about Indigenous peoples, like... I just saw the thing with like Mark Zuckerberg trying to sue Native people in Hawaii in order to build there or something. Like, is that it? Is it just like racism and people just don't care? Is that as simple as that?
Yes, it is as simple as that. And there's been some great work done by a group called Illuminatives, which seeks to work against general Indigenous erasure in this country. We tend to like to think about Native peoples in the past and not as contemporary communities that are distinct. And so getting that narrative out there of, you know, while we are all part of a long and ancient people, we are also a part of contemporary society that is unique and faces, in many cases, very disproportionate impacts from all kinds of things. And this pandemic has really highlighted it. But everything from, you know, criminal justice reform issues, health outcomes, educational outcomes, you know, we're still dealing with all of that. A part of it is, you know, tribes have only really been able and allowed by the federal government to self-govern since the 70s. After the first civil rights movement, we were a byproduct of some of that, of looking at racial justice issues. But nearly, you know, because people don't learn an accurate history, they don't understand that it just isn't, the racial inequities are there, but they don't understand a part of the solution is empowering the political status of tribes and the ability to self-govern and come up with the solutions themselves. Because we know from 400 years of policy making at the federal level that they're really bad at it. And have contributed to this. So the answers are really in our own community and building up the strength. When tribes have the means to self-govern, and this is what's been highlighted through tribes being able to raise some of their own money through having their own enterprises, in particular gaming, is that where they put the money is really smart and preventative. It's in scholarships. It's in school. It's in promoting health, not just managing diseases. It is about nutrition. It is about the resiliency that comes from connection to culture and identity in a positive way and not through, you know, bastardized representations in the media or racial slurs on sports teams, et cetera,
right,
et cetera.
Yeah, I was reading too. I mean, you know, it seems like there is a terrible history of Indigenous people always being the most affected by pandemics or diseases. And so there was, you know, this thing of like preventative, I don't know if this is true, like prevent, like that Native Americans sort of have preventative measures or are sort of used to. I mean, you mentioned being like, yeah, we've been poor before. Like, we'll shut down. Like, is that sort of a thing where it's like not a new experience? So like Native Americans are like, yeah, like we know how to handle this.
Well, I think that there have been lessons learned, and I think that a part of the way that we look at ourselves now is that for those of us here today, we look at very much the sacrifices of our parents and our grandparents and our great grandparents. And we know how different it is for us today. And in order to honor their sacrifices, to give us more opportunity, then it also comes with the realization that today is different. And so it's kind of hard to complain, right? Because we do have it better, and we are still here. Genocide didn't work. Assimilation didn't work. And while we enjoy and are slowly building a private sector economy and robust government services and building our governance capability, there's also this notion that little has come to Native Americans without sacrifice. And we also know that inherently, systems are fairly institutionally racist. And there are consistently, yearly, challenges to us being able to be self-governing, to being able to be self-sufficient. There's this deficit mentality that if tribes do well, you know, other people don't always like that, right? We liked our Indians pouring on the reservation and dependent. You know, what
Why?
Is this? Well, racism, right? And that's, you know, it's majority culture institutions, right? And it's a way to keep us compliant and, you know, is to say, well, we'll take away your economic security. You see this in states where they're negotiating with tribes around gaming revenue. Give us more or else we will compete with you or we won't honor the gaming compacts. Give us more, give us more. It's like, wait, we gave you the state. That was the deal, right? We gave up our land so you could create states And the deal was that you would provide health care, you would provide housing, you would provide education. We paid for those things in land so that there could be a United States. And that was a perpetual obligation that has never been fulfilled. Now you don't like us doing it for ourselves either. So make up your mind.
And I feel like the treaties come up for debate so often, like in the Supreme Court, or like it just keeps, it's like a continuous renegotiation almost that's so futile.
Which was interesting in the case last week, McGirt, which wasn't even about land. It was about jurisdiction. Do tribes have a right to expect a certain level of public safety on the lands that they reserved in their reservation? So the good news for tribes out of some of the recent Supreme Court decisions is that Justice Gorsuch actually has some background in Indian law, being a justice that has come from the West and has had more experience as a federal judge with Indian law. But normally Supreme Court justices don't end up there with a knowledge of Indian law. So then it's even the Supreme Court ends up being fairly inconsistent. So Gorsuch has been consistent in sharing his knowledge with the court and understanding kind of the rules of treaty making and what they meant. And so tribes took heart last week that maybe that will bring a period of stability for Indian law out of the Supreme Court.
Was the decision wasn't positive, right?
It was. It was positive.
Oh,
for
it
tribes,
was.
For tribes, it was positive. It says that for the Muscogee Creek Nation, that their original homelands that were promised to them, that they retain criminal jurisdiction over their original homelands. It doesn't give them the land back that's been lost, but it says that their jurisdiction remains. For tribal members only, though.
Are there persistent health disparities for Native Americans? For instance, like, you know, for COVID, pre-existing conditions are an issue. And
diabetes.
I think diabetes. Yeah. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. We have over a 50% rate of, in some communities, of diabetes. They think that the overprevalence of diabetes in Native American communities was triggered somewhat by the abrupt change in diet when the reservation system was instituted in the, you know, mid to late 1800s. We weren't hunter-gatherers and cultivators anymore. All of a sudden, you know, through the years, they were bringing in commodity foods, surplus foods through USDA, where you had white flour, you know, meat, canned and lard, butter, cheese, and we just weren't dairy people, right? You know, but then the high carbohydrate content, because that's the food of the poor, right? It fills you up. Type 1 and type 2 diabetes run quite high. Heart disease also runs higher in tribal communities, as do some cancers. Underlying health conditions, hypertension as well. Underlying health conditions, you know, especially in our elderly population are quite concerning, which is one of the reasons why tribes running their own health services end up being really important.
So, like, now the U.S. is sort of rushing to reopen states' economies. Like, does that affect anything for people living on tribal lands?
No, those are solely tribal decisions for tribal enterprises.
So, like, when casinos and all that stuff shut down, did that affect the, like, U.S. economy in any way? Like, was that counted as, you know, a loss for anyone other than the tribes?
In many areas, you'll see tribes be the largest employer in their area. I'll take my own tribe, for example, the Fond du Lac Banner Lake Superior Chippewa. We're the second largest employer in all of northern Minnesota. So it's over a $300 million economic impact annually to the region. They draw from like 18 different counties for workers, a workforce of 2,200, you know, and this is rural northern Minnesota. So, you know, I think that as much as tribal drivers of economy haven't been considered off reservation, despite tribes kind of trumpeting it over and over, that this will be a chance to begin that conversation with jurisdictions around them, around, you know, tribal economic development. And the more that we can diversify our own economies to not be so hospitality related will actually be really good for rural economies in many cases. So the thing to remember about hospitality industries is it funds other jobs on the reservation. So if we don't have the money coming in from the casino, that's what we use to subsidize our transit. So then the transit needs to shut down, you know, and that multiplier effect within government. So one of the statistics I saw was, you know, 1.1 million jobs across the country were impacted by COVID in Indian country.
Is that mostly Native Americans working at the casinos or like just anyone in the rural area? Like it's all types of people in that area.
In fact, it's mostly non-natives. Out of that 1.1 million, it's estimated that over 900,000 of those jobs are by non-natives. Although we should say that non-natives might be family members of tribal families.
Were they able to get the people that can't work, were they able to get the stimulus checks?
So they still remain citizens of the states and the counties and the U.S. So, you know, they are eligible for unemployment and, you know, the payments that were coming for those impacted by COVID.
Are the tribes able? I know you said it was delayed, but.
So that was money that came to the government, not to our enterprises. We weren't able to access the PPE for businesses. We were left out of that. But
Why?
We were able, I don't know. There's not a good answer to that. Even though we're employers, we should have been eligible, but we were left out of eligibility in the legislation. So the CARES Act money came for government and the Treasury Department put a lot of rules on it that it can't just subsidize the government services that you had to close down. It had to be a new cost that was incurred directly because of COVID.
What?
Yes.
And the individual people can't apply for, can they apply for unemployment? Can they apply for?
Yes, they can. Yes, they can.
Okay.
Yeah.
And can they apply, they can't apply individually for stimulus checks that had to go to the,
no, they
to the tribal government?
Yes, they
Could
get, they could get those, but the CARES Act money was only for tribal governments.
Right.
Yeah.
And so a lot of them just didn't, straight up didn't qualify?
No, they qualified, but so they had the money sent to them, but when they report back, they can only use the money for new COVID-related expenses. Otherwise, it would, they'll be found non-compliant and Treasury can ask for the money back.
But what? That's so vague.
Yep.
and might not actually be helpful to what they actually need money for.
Exactly. So it's that paternalistic big brother federal government stuff that really kind of turns the clock back on understanding that tribes know what's best for them. And it's okay to have some rules, but at least have that conversation with us. And this is where the government to government relationship comes in, right? You're supposed to talk to us. We're supposed to tell you what we need. And you're supposed to listen to that and actually give it due consideration. And when you do that, you come out with the best outcomes. So what a novel thought, right?
I know. All right, it's time for one last break, and we'll be right back. And we're back. Is this administration different than under Obama?
Oh, night and day.
Really?
They don't consult with tribes. They don't listen when tribes tell them what they need. In some cases, they've undone decisions that were requested by tribes. The Bears Ears National Monument, which is a sacred place and had five tribes working together to preserve it. They undid that and opened the areas up for oil and gas drilling, which will actually wreck Native patrimony that goes back eons and is a part of our American history. Dakota Access Pipeline, that was put on hold for an environmental impact statement and then reinstated, I think, on day three or five of the Trump administration as an executive act and just got struck down last week by a judge and said they had to actually do the environmental impact statement. So, there's been a retraction of, we've had funding issues, but mostly it's about the relationship and the different federal agencies not listening to tribes. They've been trying to decentralize the Bureau of Indian Affairs and Indian serving programs out of the Department of Interior and, move the federal staff all over the country, hoping to destabilize the workforce. And it's just one thing after another.
And it's about profits. It's about money. It's why?
They don't care and feel a duty to tribes regarding that government to government relationship and what we call the trust responsibility. So the way that tribes look at what's required of the federal government in terms of treaty resources, what was promised, we call that the trust relationship. It was actually defined by a previous Supreme Court, the Marshall Court, of saying that the U.S. has a duty of care to tribes, much like a dependent child. And so this administration doesn't feel that same duty of care.
Is there any hesitation to reopen casinos after witnessing COVID spikes when the U.S. reopened its bars and economies and stuff like that?
I would say that, yes, all of the tribes continue to take COVID quite seriously. I have talked to tribal leadership and many of the tribes, and some of them are reopening, but they're reopening in a very restricted manner, meaning that it's only open for certain kinds of guests, like maybe they're better players. They're shutting down some of their floor so that they can social distance better, cleaning and other protocols regarding health, requiring masks to enter and to keep them up, and training their staff to tell people, put the mask up or you're going to have to leave, and enforcing it. So they've been talking to each other through, the various means that tribes have to develop best practices around what that would look like. And some aren't open yet. They're waiting to see how things go. Make sure those measures work. You'll get a little bit of everything, but most of them are not open, and certainly none of them are open in the same way that they were before COVID.
Right. Yeah. I just am like, of course the government's going to let the tribes. I mean, just when I was reading that the rates are five times, I guess, what they are in the rest of the U.S., I was like, of course they're just going to ignore. They're like not going to. I mean, they're not like really offering help other than what's being asked, right?
It's coming slow. Especially on Navajo, where it got to be a mainstream media story about the lack of attention. They had asked for like a FEMA field hospital and were actually turned down for a while. And then after it became a bigger story, that kind of public pressure came to bear, and then they brought in a field hospital. you know, and then other people kicked in, philanthropy kicked in, and there was some grassroots organizing around food security issues, and that took off when people heard about how, you know, atrocious the outcomes were down there. And so, you know, it's been a mixture. You know, the federal government is finally doing some of these things. Is it at a level that is necessary? Probably not. But I think that many of the tribes have found kind of reorientating what is normal for them, and also just kind of exerting their authority, like instituting checkpoints.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's a little bit of this and a little bit of that, you know, and some tribes are real small and just don't have a lot of capacity. But then because of that, you know, they had less to manage to shut down too, right? So, and then you had some fairly large players where it was much more disruptive.
A couple more questions. I'm just curious, when, you know, so much of tribal life is gathering in person for like traditions and rituals. And like you said, the early on super spreader that happened in the Navajo Nation, what are tribes doing to replace that or to do to keep that up, I guess, if you can't meet in person?
So they're not replacing it in person.
Wow.
The large gatherings that normally happen in tribal communities in the summer, are public events like our powwows, ceremonies, they've just been ceased. And some of the governmental functions that aren't as tied to government, you know, have gone online, like government meetings, although there is also a lack of broadband in many tribal communities that also inhibit moving to an online format for government and as well as the education of our children. There's also kind of disproportionate access to high-speed internet, which complicates things in this day and age. But tribes have opted to prioritize tribal health over everything.
So what can people do to help, or what are someone listening to this, like what are some ways that, like, if you're not an Indigenous person or you don't live on tribal land or anything, like where can you read more? What can you do?
So the Harvard Project on American Indian Economic Development has a COVID toolbox. You'll find a ton of stories there, a ton of data. From them stories, you'll hear about some of the tribes that are doing innovative work, but also some of the ones that are challenged, just to increase your general knowledge so that you're making these decisions in an informed way. You have some larger Native nonprofits like the National Congress of American Indians, which is kind of like our association, so to speak, that has a fund, the Indian Collective. And Indian is NDN. Collective, mm-hmm. Has been taking donations to redistribute to tribes and tribal members. If you're interested in particular Navajo and Hopi, because of their size and their impact, you can just kind of Google Navajo Hopi Relief, and you'll find both direct-to-government opportunities to give as well as grassroots initiatives.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. This is like exactly the type of thing that we try to boost here on the show.
Well, I really thank you for your interest. As we discussed earlier, you know, sometimes working in Indian country and trying to get attention to the issues that affect us, it's difficult because we are a little invisible sometimes. And so anytime we get interest from outside of our communities, we're grateful. So thank you.
Whenever we end a episode that has a lot to do with racism, there is this increasing frustration in my gut that comes from wanting to find a different reason for why things are this way, and then being faced again and again with the simple answer of erasure and racism, and that people just do not care. And, you know, Karen Diver says, thank you for having me on, because like we always want to talk to people outside the nation. What does that say about us as a country? Like, I don't feel like that should be some huge thing that I'm doing. Like, I feel like not only should the federal government and federal agencies be listening to the tribes, but we should be listening to the tribes. I want to say something. There's real hope for racial justice that's happening right now. There's real movement for change. And I think we should include Indigenous people. I know I'm not the first or 400th person to say that, but if we're dealing in racial injustice, we gotta talk to and about Indigenous peoples as well. Thanks for listening. Make sure you're subscribed to our show on Stitcher or wherever you find your podcasts. The show is produced by Tamika Weatherspoon. Our audio engineer is Brendan Burns, and our audio is mixed by Andy Christens. Our executive producers are Chris Bannon and Josephine Martirana. Original music is composed by Zach Sherwin, Mike Kaplan, and Jack Dolgen. Our theme song is performed by Sam Barbera. Bad with Money is a production of Stitcher. I'm Gabby Dunn, and see you next week for the season 6 finale.